The Israeli regime had close military links with the apartheid regime in South Africa and Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. The regime has also been selling weapons, fueling civil wars in several African countries. Now, the Israeli regime is literally plundering the resources of the Democratic Republic of Congo, widely considered to be the richest country in the world in terms of natural resources. Considering the foregoing, can we say that the African Union should categorically reject the Israeli regime's attempt to become an observer member?
I mean, the decision for Israel to become an observatory member of the African Union did not come from the African people. No, African people have always been on the side of the Palestinian people. The African Union has put a statement denouncing the apartheid that the Palestinian people live in, that's imposed on them by Israel. So we, the African people, are very clear about what the Palestinian people are living. What took place was an undemocratic process of electing or pretty much imposing on the African people the status of Israel within the African Union.
It is quite interesting that the Israeli regime sought to oust DRC's president and at the same time used him in its attempt to gain observer status at the African Union. Now, very briefly as we wind up, should this be a warning bell to African leaders that they cannot trust the Tel Aviv regime?
Those leaders on the African continent who are supporting Israel, behind their backs, Israel is plotting a coup in the case of the Congo, while the Congolese president is supporting Israel. The head of intelligence of Israel, Cohen, allegedly was plotting a coup in DRC. That's a signal for those leaders who are supporting Israel that they may even turn against you. So they should be on the side of the African people, of supporting the people of Palestine, demanding that the Palestinians can return on their land, control their own affairs, and live peacefully and freely in their land like any human being should live.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Kambale Musavoli of the Center for Research on the Congo for his incisive analysis. Now we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall be talking about the status of the access to electricity in Africa. Stay with us.
Lighting up Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Poor electricity access is one of the biggest developmental challenges facing many African countries. Millions of people across the continent live in complete darkness, unable to access electricity for basic household use such as lighting, charging phones, and laptops.
In their recent book titled The Challenge of Energy Access in Africa, authors Manfred Hafner, Simone Talia Pietra, and Lucia de Strasser identified four major problems militating against energy access on the continent. Decades of neglect in building up countrywide infrastructure, a lack of international investment, poor regulatory frameworks, and difficulties surrounding bankability of power projects.
According to the Africa Development Bank, over 640 million Africans have no access to energy, corresponding to an electricity access rate for African countries at just over 40%, the lowest in the world. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank Group, Akinwumi Adesina, says lack of electricity is killing industries in Nigeria, Africa's largest economy.
You see, ladies and gentlemen, a lack of electricity is killing Nigerian industries. Something Chief Odutola was concerned about way back in 1971. According to the Manufacturers Association of Nigeria, industries spend $93.1 billion, and billion naira, I must say, on alternative energy in 2018. That is 47 years after Chief Odutola. Today, no business can survive in Nigeria without generators. Consequently, the abnormal has become normal.
Well, for more on the state of electricity supply in Africa, we contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Okay.
Now, why is access to electricity the biggest development challenge facing many African countries, yet the continent is home to vast energy resources?
The problem is that the African nations have never been able to build up the infrastructure, of which energy is the most important feature, for their economies. Don't forget, since the emergence of the African nations in the 1960s, there has been, from the West, a refusal to help these nations actually develop by making investments in infrastructure, by making investments in energy. All kinds of aid has been delivered, and all kinds of speeches have been made. And the lack of energy in Africa is literally killing Africans, not figuratively, but literally, because you can't have an industrialized economy without energy. And if you don't have an industrialized economy, people live in poverty and die.
South Africa, Africa's second largest economy, has the highest energy consumption on the continent. Yet unscheduled power outages are on the increase. The country's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, last year announced another project to deal with the country's energy crisis.
Through this Hydrogen South Africa strategy, government and its partners have successfully deployed hydrogen fuel cells to provide electricity in some of our schools and to build hospitals established as part of the country's COVID-19 response.
North Africa seems to be relatively well off compared to sub-Saharan Africa in terms of access to electricity. What is the situation in African countries such as Nigeria and South Africa?
Across sub-Saharan Africa, not counting the Maghreb, in sub-Saharan Africa, the lack of energy is pervasive and deadly. And there's no country. Look, there's only 100 to 110,000 megawatts of power capacity for over a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa. 40,000 is produced in South Africa, but South Africa doesn't have enough energy. And you have other countries like Nigeria, which are living on less than 100 watts of electricity per capita. So there is no good news story. There is no one, there's no country who's delivering energy, and not even close to the energy that's needed. My estimates are we need 1,000 gigawatts of electricity, and all we have is 100,000 megawatts. So the deficit is striking.
Ethiopia's Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is said to be the largest hydroelectric scheme in Africa, but has been at the center of regional dispute. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed officially inaugurated electricity production from the country's mega dam on the Blue Nile in February.
Now, Mr. Freeman, what impact will the Ethiopia dam have on efforts to ensure greater access to electricity in African countries?
The most significant development is Ethiopia has a Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, and they embarked on this about 10 years ago. And within the next month or two, they will be involved in the third filling of this dam. This will be the largest dam on the continent of Africa. It will have a reservoir of about 74 billion cubic meters, estimated to generate over 6,000 megawatts. Now, this will be a significant increase for Ethiopia, and they will also export energy to the region, Kenya, South Sudan, maybe Tanzania. But it's still not enough, but it's a big development.
Now, although many in other continents are moving towards nuclear energy, South Africa remains the only African country that generates nuclear energy. Other countries such as Nigeria, Egypt, and Kenya have plans to set up nuclear power plants. Now, do you think nuclear energy can be an option for Africa?
You have about 16 or 17 African countries in various phases of acquiring nuclear energy, which would be the best for Africa, and it's the best form of energy. Egypt, I think, is working with Russia to build several nuclear energy plants. South Africa is embarking on a plan to build possibly four nuclear power plants, and many other countries, Ghana, Nigeria, and others, are in the process of acquiring permits and feasibility studies. This would be a huge increase for Africa to start deploying nuclear energy.
A recent report by Wood Mackenzie Limited says sub-Saharan African countries will need to invest as much as $350 billion between now and 2030 to be able to considerably improve electricity and generation distribution. Now, is this objective achievable in your opinion?
What I've been working on with my African friends is to establish an Africa Infrastructure Development Bank, which would be a bank that would lend out money, credit, for infrastructure, of which energy would be the primary, along with high-speed railroads, would be the most important investments for this infrastructure bank. And the West just turns away a blind eye to the actual needs of Africa and energy. And without energy, you won't solve the food crisis. Without energy, you won't end hunger. Without energy, you won't end poverty. And yet, the Western institutions do nothing but complain and feel bad, but they won't make the investment necessary. Russia and China and India will probably do more in providing nuclear energy for Africa than the West.
According to some reports, over 30% of electricity in France generated by uranium for Niger, yet only 1 in 7 Nigerians have access to modern electricity services. Can we say that the exploitation by former colonial powers such as France is a major factor in lack of electricity in Africa?
And it's true, the French never developed their 14 countries that are part of Francophone arrangements. And they basically are carrying out the colonial policy of taking the resource of uranium to develop their own energy base, nuclear base, and doing nothing to help Niger.
Renewable energy's potential across the African continent remains largely untapped. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank says the bank is funding renewable energy projects in the continent. Let's take a listen.
Africa has abundant energy resources, including solar, hydro, geothermal, and also wind. The African Development Bank is spearheading investments in renewable energy. And guess what? 85% of all the African Development Bank's investment in energy is in renewable energy.
Now, my last question to Mr. Freeman, what is preventing the wider use of renewable energy sources such as solar, which is readily available across Africa?
Well, it is, and the problem you have is you have a whole colonial mindset which dominates the West. There's a totally different thinking coming from China in particular. The West, in their colonial mindset, have never intended to develop Africa. We have an anti-development mindset, which corresponds in some ways to a colonial mindset. And this continent with all these resources has never been developed, and that's by intention. And that is very sad, and that's what I'm trying to change with my work and my website and my writings and my lectures.
Well, there you have it. Western neocolonial powers led by the United States prefer an underdeveloped Africa so that they can continue looting the continent's resources. That's the opinion of Lawrence Freeman, an expert on African affairs. We'd like to thank him for his insight on the subject. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle. Take care and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has made a dramatic intervention to try to halt Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel's plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Diane Taylor and Rajiv Sial. The piece is titled Home Office Misled Refugees About UN Involvement in Rwanda Plans, Court Told. The United Nations Refugee Agency has made a dramatic intervention to try to halt the British Home Secretary Priti Patel's plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. In a late submission of evidence, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees claimed the Home Secretary Priti Patel misled refugees over the organization's support for the plan. The agency has also said the scheme failed to meet the required standards of legality and appropriateness for transferring asylum seekers from one country to another. It emerged on Friday, 10th of June, that the British government has cancelled the removal directions for three people who had asked the High Court to prevent their deportation. In the hearing, it emerged two more people will also have them cancelled. Letters sent by the Home Office to those seeking asylum assured them that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, was closely involved in the scheme to send people to the East African country of Rwanda, the High Court was told. But a letter from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, to the Home Office Minister, Tom Persclove, questioned this claim. We're also concerned by statements made in the letters indicating that UNHCR has not expressed substantial concerns with regard to the shortcomings in the capacity of the Rwandan asylum system, the agency wrote. The letter emerged at the first legal challenge of the policy, which was heard on Friday, 10th of June, at the Royal Courts of Justice. The refugee charities Detention Action and Care for Calais and the Public and Commercial Services Union have applied for an urgent interim injunction preventing any flights from leaving, including the first, until after its application for a judicial review can be heard. The High Court was told the UNHCR had a number of concerns about the asylum process in Rwanda, including discriminatory access to asylum. A lack of legal representation and interpreters and difficulties in launching an appeal. Laura Dubinsky, QC, the barrister for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, said the refugee agency was concerned about inaccuracies in Home Office claims about its involvement in the scheme, saying it in no way endorses it and had told the British government it believed it to be unlawful. Raza Hussain QC for the claimant said Priti Patel had misrepresented the UNHCR's position. These are concerns that have been communicated to the British authorities, and yet the Secretary of State's position is that the UNHCR has given this plan a green light. But this is a false claim, he said. In court documents, Home Office lawyers urged the court to reject the application, arguing it fails at the first stage, adding, the claimants have not identified a serious issue to be tried, still less the strong case they allege for the grant of relief at trial. In the papers, Rory Dunlop QC and Matthew Gullick QC for the department said, the application for interim relief should be dismissed. In the alternative, any order for interim relief should be limited. The claim and application ran to many hundreds of pages, the lawyers said, as they suggested there had been delays in serving the papers, arguing, given the volume of material that has now been served, this delay has prejudiced the defendant's ability to respond to the interim relief application. The High Court is due to hear a further challenge to the policy on Monday, brought by the refugee charity Asylum Aid and supported by the campaign group Freedom from Torture. Number 10 Downing Street said Prime Minister Boris Johnson was still hopeful the first flight would go ahead on Tuesday. A number 10 Downing Street spokesperson said, "Yes, you're aware of the ongoing court case today, but we have set our position on why we think this is the right approach." Meanwhile, a High Court judge in London has ruled that a controversial deportation flight to Rwanda that was due to take off early next week can go ahead. The High Court judge, Mr. Justice Swift, refused to grant interim relief, urgent action in response to an injunction application made by several asylum seekers facing offshoring to Rwanda. Lawyers acting for the asylum seekers and the groups had argued the policy was unlawful and sought the urgent injunction to stop next week's planned flight and any other such flights ahead of a full hearing on the case later on this year. The decision will not stop individual refugees from further legal challenges to their removal to Rwanda or a judicial review of the policy, which Mr. Justice Swift said could take 6 weeks. The High Court judge, Mr. Justice Swift, supported submissions made by the Home Secretary Priti Patel and rejected the application to halt the Rwanda flight next Tuesday, but granted permission to the claimants to appeal, suggesting Court of Appeal judges would hear the case on Monday, 13th of June. The High Court judge, Mr. Justice Swift, said there was a material public interest in allowing the Secretary of State to be able to implement immigration control decisions. He also said that some of the risks of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda outlined by the claimants were very small and in their realms of speculation. Home Secretary Priti Patel will see this as a significant victory following concern that the offshoring plan would be stopped in the courts of law. The government has claimed that the plan is designed to deter migrants from making dangerous channel crossings and to break the business model of people smugglers. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, welcomed the court's decision, saying people will continue to try and prevent their relocation through legal challenges and last-minute claims, but we will not be deterred in breaking the deadly people smuggling trade and ultimately saving lives. Prime Minister Boris Johnson also welcomed the ruling, saying, "We cannot allow people traffickers to put lives at risk, and our world-leading partnership will help break the business model of these ruthless criminals." Also, the scheme has been reportedly criticised in private by Prince Charles.
Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit. But behind this resounding success lies a dark secret: toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither surrounding residents nor the company's employees. Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples in confidential documents.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-block, this is where all the medical tests and the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh, man, I'm about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability, an industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, there are new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common: a culture of secrecy.
You're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry.
Everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and it was secure.
Are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency, cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey, man, what can I say? There's no way in the world. If they would have informed us back then, that we would participate.
No. No, no, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't bite it now.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long, people were coming.
Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This cereal is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found it in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interests, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
Oh, this is where we used to have the zip line way back here.
Okay.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. I don't even know if you can see any of them over here. But 18 years and the land is very fertile, and it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore, and they could build forts, and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007. When tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency, the levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
My oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have 5 kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree, and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's. This is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, 3 times the U.S. average.
We had been married 46 years when he died. And would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.
The American Environmental Agency has finally forced Dow to clean the river. But the process has only just begun. It could take decades and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. However, no date is set for decontaminating neighboring yards, like Alice Buchelter's. Dow refused all our requests for an interview. The multinational merely sent us an email stating that we seek science-based solutions that protect human health while also contributing to the well-being of the local community. On the other side of the world, another contamination is wreaking havoc. As a result of one of the worst industrial catastrophes in history, thousands of children have been affected. But Dow has never dealt with it. It happened in India, in Bhopal. In 1984, the local chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people and releasing tons of toxic products. At the time, the factory belonged to Union Carbide, a pesticide giant that Dow would buy up in 2001. The site of the Bhopal explosion is still saturated with chemical pollution. Over the years, these products have spread into the city's groundwater systems. For 15 years, the inhabitants have demanded a full decontamination. In vain, Dow refuses to act. The decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Xuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
There are so many chemicals still remaining in this quality control lab. Very few bottles are now at present. But after the disaster, this quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums, and after 32 years, still they are lying.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there is no proper care of these premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
The whole area is highly contaminated. They are dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Xuan shows us where the pesticides were made. Beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground. The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells, like in Shakya's family home. They've lived in the house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter. two times the standard level of toxicity. The problem is, even in boiled water, mercury is still carcinogenic. In other areas of Bhopal, it's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Pritnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rachna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit. Due to her disabilities, Rachna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Convincing a deeply polarized American public that the January 6th Capitol riot was not a spontaneous act of violence, but the culmination of a months-long plot by former President Donald Trump and his allies to undermine the results of the 2020 presidential election, is no easy task for the House Select Committee investigating the deadly assault on the Capitol. We have prepared for you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, January 6th Hearing, Trump Was at Heart of Plot That Led to Attempted Coup. House Select Committee investigating the deadly January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol in 2021 said former President Donald Trump was at the center of a sprawling conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election that culminated in an attempted coup. With a shocking new accounting of the worst attack on the halls of U.S. Congress in more than two centuries, the committee outlined the gripping detail over the course of 2 hours on Thursday night, 9th of June. The grave threat posed to American democracy then and now by the former president's actions. In new evidence, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming and the committee's vice chair, said of Donald Trump, "Aware of the rioters' chance to hang Mike Pence, his vice president, the president responded with his statement, 'Maybe our supporters have the right idea. Mike Pence deserves it.'" Congressman Benny Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat and chair of the committee, said, "The American people deserve answers," adding, "So tonight and over the next few weeks, we're going to remind you of the reality of what happened on that day." Congressman Benny Thompson and Congresswoman Liz Cheney laid out what they described as the unconstitutional misconduct of a former president who continues to peddle the lie that the election he lost to the Democrats, Joe Biden, was stolen from him, a lie they argue that he knows to be false. Liz Cheney said during the primetime proceedings, "All Americans should keep in mind this fact. On the morning of 6th of January 2021, President Donald Trump's intention was to remain President of the United States despite the lawful outcome of the 2020 presidential election, and in violation of his constitutional obligation to relinquish power." Their presentation featured never-before-seen video clips from the attack by extremist supporters of Donald Trump, who stormed the U.S. Capitol building to try to stop Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win. In a cinematic display meant to grip a weary public, the House panel weaved video footage of the violence together with live testimony and videotaped depositions from some of Donald Trump's closest allies and family members. These included the former Attorney General William Barr, Donald Trump's daughter and White House advisor Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner, and a longtime aide and spokesperson Jason Miller. The effect was piercing. The first of six public hearings offered revelations on what Congressman Benny Thompson described as a sprawling multi-step conspiracy aimed at overturning the presidential election. Members of the audience gasped when Liz Cheney said Donald Trump, after being informed the mob was calling for Mike Pence to be hanged, told aides that perhaps his vice president deserved it. Donald Trump was furious that Mike Pence, presiding over a joint session of Congress in what is typically a ceremonial role, refused to reject the certification of Joe Biden's victory, as Trump publicly and privately pressured him to do. The committee showed a clip of William Barr saying he repeatedly told Donald Trump in no uncertain terms that he had lost the election, and the claims of it being stolen because of widespread voting fraud was simply untrue. In another interview, Ivanka Trump said she accepted William Barr's determination that the presidential election had been fair. On Friday morning, 10th of June, Donald Trump posted on his own Truth Social platform, having been banned from Twitter, calling William Barr weak and frightened, and his own daughter checked out. Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney also announced that multiple House Republicans sought pardons from Donald Trump for their involvement in the insurrection, including Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who declined a request to testify before the committee. Scott Perry's office denied the allegation. The evening presentation also included witnesses' testimony from Nick Questad, a British documentary filmmaker who was embedded with the far-right Proud Boys militia group that led the storming of the Capitol. Video footage he filmed helped chronicle the Proud Boys' involvement in planning the assault. On Friday morning, 10th of June, British documentary filmmaker Nick Questad told ABC's Good Morning America that at the point the far-right extremists he was filming breached the first barriers on the outskirts of the Capitol, it all changed, as men protesting far-left